You're listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. This is season 14, episode 13. Russ Ramsey is an author and pastor with a passion for uniting art and faith. He's been in vocational ministry for more than 20 years and currently serves as the lead pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Franklin, Tennessee. He's the author of 6 books, including one our community is familiar with, Rembrandt is in the Wind, Learning to Love Art Through the Eyes of Faith. In today's episode, Russ and I discuss his new book, Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart. Our conversation explores how Van Gogh's life and art reveal universal themes of struggle and wonder, and what Van Gogh reveals about the human condition. Patrons of the podcast can enjoy an additional interview segment on why the arts are important to communities of faith. Visit patreon.com/makersandmystics to learn more. I'm your host, Stephen Roach, and this is Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart, Season 14, Episode 13. Russ, thank you so much for talking with me today on the Makers and Mystics podcast. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be a part of this. I'm looking forward to our conversation a lot.
Yes. You know, I mentioned before the recording that our community has spent a lot of time with your work. We went through Rembrandt is in the Wind. We had a book club. It was like a 4-week book club where we went through all the chapters of your book, and it was really impactful for the artists and the creatives in our crew. And so I'm excited to have this conversation with you now about your book, Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It very much is a follow-up to Rembrandt is in the Wind. It's another 10 chapters, 10 stories about artists and works of art that they've made, and kind of the intersection of art, faith, suffering. And really, there's a theme in here, too, of how art tells us our story back to ourselves.
Interesting. Well, that sounds like a beautiful point to dive in. Talk to me about how art tells our story back to us. What is all that about?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a reason why cities around the world have constructed museums and then filled them with these paintings and sculptures made by people down through time. It's if you think about it, just kind of, you know, if you were an alien to visit this planet and you walked into some of these buildings, you might wonder, what are these for? Like, why are these the paintings that are in this museum? Why are these the statues? Why are these the artists who occupy these spaces? And a lot of the reason for that is because in our kind of collective human experience, these are the works and these are the artists and these are the eras that are helping us understand a significant part of our history, which is more than just political history or economic history or industrial history, but it's the story of humanity kind of finding its way and suffering and breaking. I think, you know, there's a chapter in the book that focuses on Norman Rockwell. And Norman Rockwell is one of those artists who his job was to tell America's story back to her by way of Saturday Evening Post covers throughout the 1900s. And so he painted magazine covers for 50 or 60 years. And so he was capturing America as we were going through, coming out of the Great Depression, as we were entering World War II, as we were going through the 50s and 60s. He was capturing those decades and showing America back on these covers that he would do for the Saturday Evening Post. And one of the fascinating things is, I think a lot of times when people think of a painter like Norman Rockwell, they think of sentimentality. They think of kind of this kind of schmaltzy, maybe even a little bit kind of tongue-in-cheek paintings. But he was actually a very serious narrator in his works. And one of the reasons that his work was so attractive and captured people was because he was singularly focused on the subject of human beings. So he wasn't a landscape painter. It was all scenes with people. People in moments that had some connection to what was going on in America. And one of the fascinating things, and the chapter kind of deals with this, is that Norman Rockwell himself changed as a his perspective on America deepened and changed, and he corrected himself over time, particularly when it comes to issues of civil rights. He was a painter who, when he was starting off, the Saturday Evening Post editors said, if you're going to include people of color in your cover art, then don't do it very often. And when you do it, they should be probably in positions of servitude. And so it'd be a waiter on a train or things like that. And he did that. And then he became fascinated by the story of Ruby Bridges, this little girl who went to a kindergartner who went to school in the desegregated South and had to be escorted by U.S. Marshals. And he has this painting that he painted called The Problem We All Live With, which is this little girl, a six-year-old girl, carrying school books, tomatoes splattered on the wall next to her, two U.S. Marshals in front of her, two U.S. Marshals behind her, escorting her into kindergarten. And he called it The Problem We All Live With. And he was in the process of, I don't know if repenting would be the exact word to use, but he was in the process of trying to deal honestly with his vocation. And his vocation is to illustrate American life. And for the vast majority of his career, what he illustrated was a very particular kind of American life. And then when we got into the 60s and he started capturing this moment, it signaled a shift in how he worked. He didn't become he wouldn't have become somebody that you would think of as a civil rights activist necessarily, but the painting that I focus on in the chapter is called Murder in Mississippi, and it's a painting of a moment right before a lynching. And it's terrifying. It's a terrifying painting. And you look at it and you think, this is Norman Rockwell. This is the same guy who did the referee doing the coin toss with the two lanky football players. Like, this is the same person. And it's a great picture of an artist learning over time how to best tell the story of the moment that he's in, even if it means that he's revealing that he himself has had to change. And that kind of body of work is confrontational in the best ways for people who engage with that, because it's telling us our story back of how that world changed for him while he was living it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's such a fascinating observation on the arts and how not only do they reflect our stories back to us, as you're saying, but also we can see the development of their own journey within their art and within the decades of their body of work. And I know that this book, Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart, centers on the artistry of Van Gogh as sort of a metaphor, if you will, for the subjects you're talking about. Do you see that in Van Gogh's work as well, a development of his own spiritual journey, or even the development of how he changed as a human being, how he saw the world differently over time?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. He only painted for about 8.5 to 9 years, which is crazy to think about when you think about Van Gogh's body of work. And one of the things that's so mystifying about that is just the volume that he put out. And one of the things that you see in his life, and I wrote about this in Rembrandt is in the Wind, is the output of Van Gogh's work is one of the interesting tells about his life, is that he started kind of as a painter who was painting a lot, but he wasn't painting so much that you would think, wow, this guy is really churning it out. And he was painting, a lot of scenes of people and kind of the world. And you can see in his earlier work him finding his way. There's a painting I love that he did of a vase of flowers, and it's early. It's maybe from 1884 or 5 somewhere. It's early. He died in 1890. And it is it's like some lilacs and some roses, and there is a single sunflower in it. And he hasn't found the sunflowers yet.
Mm.
But then he, as an artist, he kind of zeroes in, and you see it in his work. You see him zero in on blue and yellow, and you see him zero in on skies and sunflowers and agriculture, but really the sunflower. And he has this great quote in one of his letters where he's talking about, I can't remember the quote exactly, but he's talking about a couple of different painters and how one of them paints peonies and another one paints roses. And he makes the comment, he says, "The sunflowers are mine."
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about that is...
What a beautiful quote.
It really is. And there's actually a book called The Sunflowers Are Mine, which is a great little biographical sketch, a beautiful book. But one of the things that you see in the progression of him going from painting just general vases of flowers to painting sunflowers is the sunflower is so much like who he was. Where I was showing I was teaching a second grade class recently on Van Gogh, and I came in to speak to this class about him. And I showed him the sunflowers and asked them to kind of just look. I said, just, we're going to spend the next 15, 20 seconds. I don't want you to say anything. I want you to just look at this vase of sunflowers painting. And then at the end, I'm going to ask you kind of how you felt looking at it. And they said a lot of different things. But two of the kids said, "I felt sad."
Mm.
And I said, yeah, that's right. And there's something about the sunflower where they're not beautiful flowers. They're kind of a little grotesque, and they're spiky, and they're the petals are kind of small, and the big middle is this kind of thorny mess of things, and he's arranged them in these pots, and it's this perfect picture of kind of like who he was, of this thing that was craving the light, like a sunflower will follow the sun across the sky, and yet it's thorny, and it's not a flower that you pick up and smell. It's beautiful in the way that it is rough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you see Van Gogh kind of zeroing in on, those kinds of things over his career. I love engaging with bodies of work for artists. Rather, I'm not a guy who's like, I love this painting. It's more, I love Rembrandt.
Yeah.
And so his work to me is a body of work, and Van Gogh is the same way, where I do love Van Gogh paintings, and I have certain paintings framed and around places where I see them all the time, but I don't see them as the reason I love Van Gogh. It's part of the body of work, in the same way that, you know, I love Paul Simon.
Mm-hmm.
Is I don't have, there's not like there's a Paul Simon song that I just think that's the greatest song ever. It's that his body of work is such a confounding, mysterious journey of from swagger and arrogance to humility and spiritual curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that. And Van Gogh does that profoundly. Rembrandt does as well.
Yes. Well, you know, as we're talking about art reflecting our emotions back to us and looking at these large bodies of work from different artists and musicians, it makes me think sometimes we don't always understand our own drives or our own emotions or our own prejudices or preferences. And art gives us the ability to see within ourselves what we can't see on our own, I would think. And I'm curious, as you've studied and written about Van Gogh's life in particular,
mm-hmm.
how have you engaged with his work to kind of help unpack viewing some of the deeper struggles and emotions that we all have?
Yeah. One of the things, if you ever get a chance to go to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, you should, for two reasons. One, because it's just a fantastic museum. Two, it's next door to the Rijksmuseum. And so two of the greatest museums in the world share a property line. And they're spectacular. But when you enter the Van Gogh Museum, the first exhibit you encounter is self-portraits. And it's, and Van Gogh painted, I'm going to call him Vincent. I call him Vincent. It's a thing.
He's a buddy at this point, right?
Yeah. He is, it's personal. Yeah. And, he is Vincent to me. But he painted self-portraits all the time. And for somebody who only painted for 9 years, it's interesting to chronologically look at them because you see him change and you see the different eras that he went through. But if you ask somebody, what can you tell me about Vincent Van Gogh, person on the street, two things they're going to tell you is he painted Starry Night and that he cut off his ear. Those are the two things that are ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate because the episode of him cutting off his ear was the lowest point in his entire life. It's a moment of incredible shame, incredible brokenness and fear. He was a terrified, broken, hurting person when that happened. And it becomes something people joke about a lot. I wrote a chapter, there's a chapter about him in Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart, which is telling the story of him cutting off his ear, like what actually happened there. And part of the reason I wanted to tell the story is I want people to stop laughing about it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is my friend. And I think, you know, scripture is filled with people where they are known by their affliction. Blind Bartimaeus, Simon the leper, the woman caught in adultery, the woman with the issue of blood, Matthew the tax collector. You could even make a case for the rich young ruler, where these are people who are known by the things that are dragging them down, the things that kind of put them on the outside looking in. And that's how we know them in scripture. That's how they're identified. So Van Gogh has a self-portrait of his, it's called Self-Portrait with Bandaged Ear. And it's something he painted days after cutting off his ear while he was in an asylum hospital. And the courage and the ruthless honesty to tell that story visually in the way that he did is the kind of thing that as a pastor, as a man and as a pastor, makes me say, I want to be like that, in the sense that I want to be somebody who is willing to let the wounded side of me be seen. The irony being that it is a canvas that is of incalculable worth, precisely because it's a Van Gogh and it's the subject matter of this moment. And so I don't know anybody who could walk into a Sotheby's auction and buy that painting because of just the incredible value of it. And yet what it's a painting of is him telling the truth about how broken and desperate and needy and wounded he is, in a way that is of such beauty and value that it's the kind of pastor I want to be, and it's what I want our people to be, and it's who I want to be as a person. And so, you know, that's a good example for me of the way that his suffering and his kind of tormented soul as a painter has given me something that I hang above my desk. I have at my home office and at my office at the church, I have the painting above the desk. So when I look up at the wall, that's the painting I'm seeing.
Beautiful. Sometimes suffering and wonder come together in the same experience. And often we can think about wonder as this removed experience that isn't affected by pain or suffering, or, you know, that is, it's removed from the tragic realities of life.
Yeah.
I know that in your book, Van Gogh Has a Broken Heart, that's something that you grapple with, are these universal themes of struggle and wonder through the lens of Van Gogh's art. What can you tell me about those two things working together in the human experience, struggle and wonder, and how the arts play a central role in understanding those things?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that art does is it helps us engage with a range of human emotion and experience that is not exactly our own in the moment. And so it helps us practice being whole people. You know, so you walk into a gallery and you see you see a painting that is of some kind of sad subject matter, or some kind of, you walk into, you know, you go and you stand in front of Rembrandt's Return of the Prodigal Son.
Mm-hmm. Love that one.
You have this painting that is capturing this moment in a single frame. It's capturing an entire story in a single frame of a broken relationship being restored, an intact but loveless relationship finding even greater distance between the father and the elder brother. And you stand in front of this and you rifle through in your mind the relationships, the places where you connect. You think of your own seasons as a prodigal. You think of the prodigals in your own life who have walked away from you and come back. You think of those moments where we engage in some kind of folly, and the world and people that love us and are wise tell us, if you do that, it's not going to go well. And we have that kind of sin of exceptionalism where we say, I know it doesn't go well for anybody else, but it'll be fine for me, you know, and then it doesn't. And you're in that humbled place of recognizing that I am a fool. And art is storytelling, and it is, and stories are a Trojan horse for truth. You can slip a lot of things past people's defenses by telling them a story. You can say, hey, listen, if you don't put your faith in the Lord, you will live outside of a relationship with Him forever, ever, and you really need to think about that. Or you can say, there was a father and he had two sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Flannery O'Connor said, a story is a way of saying something that can't be said in any other way. And art, that's one of the things that art does, is it sneaks past our defenses and it tells us things that are true in ways that are layered and nuanced, and in ways where we find ourselves in a position of saying, actually, no, I want to hear the story. I'm invested in this. I want to know how it turns out because it matters to me. And so that's what we're doing when we engage with art, is we're letting stories be told to us that do relate.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, like one of my favorite songwriters is Jason Isbell, and as a lyricist, he's a brilliant lyricist. And one of the things that I observed about his work, there were a couple albums in particular that just were, I could not get enough of, because I felt so connected to them. But I wasn't connected to them because he was saying general things that he could relate to and I could relate to too. What he was doing instead is he was saying very specific things. He was telling, you know, the more specific he gets lyrically, the more specific a songwriter gets lyrically, ironically, the more people will connect with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they will say, oh, I have my own version of specifically what you're talking about.
Yes.
So it's, you know, so it's one thing to say, you know, ooh, baby, baby, baby. It's another thing to sing a song about a friend who's dying of cancer, and to have a line that says, I carried her to bed and I sweeped up the hair on the floor.
Yeah.
That is just like, whew.
Yes.
You know, that is a different level of love and intimacy. And it takes you deeper into the reality of it. And art, that's how art works in my life.
It's like the personal becomes the universal. It's almost like,
yes,
the more personal we can make it, the more universal it can become.
Yeah.
Whereas if we get caught in generalities, we kind of miss everyone, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, building on this, it leads me to the question of how art has a broader impact on society that goes beyond our own individual experience, and how the arts influence, you know, our societal perspectives and, you know, things like, especially because in your book, I believe you deal with mental health and emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm.
How do the arts play into that part of the conversation?
The arts will, now this doesn't apply to everything, right? Like there's, not all art is great art.
Sure.
But great art will tell you the truth. It's committed, it's devoted to telling you the truth, or at least to telling you somebody's experience as honestly as they possibly can. Great artists will want the work that they show you to be so heavily scrutinized in the process of making it that it's their best attempt at telling you something that's true. And so it doesn't beat around the bush. It's confrontational visually. And in the process of writing now two books about artists and their work, one of the through lines is that these are all sufferers.
Yeah.
These are all people who suffer, and their work is part of the way that they negotiate and navigate their own suffering, is they create. So Van Gogh is a good example of toward at the end of his life, for the last 3 months of his life before he shot himself, he painted an average of a painting a day. Just sit with that for a second.
Wow. Yeah.
And the caveat being, they're the paintings you're thinking about. It's not like they're little, like, 4 by 4 inch by 4 inch little doodles. No. These are the paintings that hang in the museums, a painting a day on average. And we know this because he wrote letters where he chronicled what he was working on when. And so, he wrote thousands of letters, and we have them all. At least we have thousands of them. Mm-hmm. If you're interested, by the way, vangoletters.com or .org, one of those two, is a fantastic website that has all of his letters arranged chronologically in French and in English, and many of them are screenshots of the letters themselves where he has sketches. It's a great rabbit hole to go down.
Wow, yeah, I'll include that in the show notes.
Yeah. It's fantastic. But you see kind of the mental health journey. And you also see the trajectories of sufferings and how suffering changes the way that young Rembrandt painted as opposed to old Rembrandt, and the subject matter and the warmth and the desperation that kind of creeps in to this painter. But I think art is one of those places where we can get one of the most direct engagements with the mental health journeys of other people, and statements made about well-being and peace. That it's Van Gogh. I just can't get enough of his story.
Yeah, you know, as we're talking about mental health, emotional well-being, suffering, and some of the darker emotions that we experience as human beings, I want to ask you this as well, taking advantage of having a pastor here on the show with us today. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's often in communities of faith that we can get the idea that as believers, you know, we're supposed to live above some of the suffering. And I know that we can have a redeemed perspective on how we relate to these darker emotions and how we can relate to these darker experiences. But I know for a lot of artists, they can feel excluded from communities of faith because there hasn't been the permission given to grapple with some of the darker emotions that we all have, or the darker experiences, the moments of our own personal failures, or the moments of mental challenges, you know? And
yeah.
I'm curious to know, for you, as you've now written two books about artists and through the lens of a spiritual leader, what can you tell me about that, and how can we encourage artists to show up in our full selves so that we can walk through some of these experiences to greater wholeness?
I think, you know, as a writer, so writing and poetry is kind of my primary artistic outlet. I think that this is a place where if you are a person of faith, if you are a believer in Jesus, then you have scripture. And one of the things that we're given in Scripture is we're given all of these stories and poems that are filled with emotional range, and they hold nothing back. You know, you've got the Psalms, I think it's Psalm 77, maybe, that the psalmist says, I stretch out untiring hands in the night, and my soul refuses to be comforted, and I cry aloud to the Lord, and you don't answer me. Mm-hmm.
That's real.
That's in the canon of Scripture.
Yeah.
And if you have a high view of the Bible, that means that God in his infinite sovereign wisdom said, this is a prayer you can pray. Mm-hmm. You can say this to me. Now, we can't say it rhetorically. We can't say it like Pontius Pilate, what is truth, uh-huh. and turn around and walk away. Because the psalm answers that, but it answers it in a way that is so true to the experience of a depressed person. And that is, the psalmist says, to this I will appeal. I will remember your faithfulness to the people of old. In other words, he doesn't say, I'm going to talk myself into positive thoughts. He says, instead, I'm going to appeal to the fact that you were faithful to the people of Israel when they were going through Edom and Moab, and they should have been wiped off the face of the earth, and you preserve them. And you don't change, and so that's who you are still, even though you're being silent with me right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to appeal to history and put my faith in the way you have cared for other people.
Yeah.
When I don't feel the way you're caring for me in the moment. That's in the Bible. You have the journeys of Peter and his denial of Jesus and this moment of profound brokenness and guilt and betrayal of a friend in a moment of need. And you see the way Jesus responds to him. And the way Jesus responds to him is he acknowledges it. He forgives him in a way that is so intentional that he leans in to the sin, so much so that he tells Peter before it even happens, "You're going to do this, and I know it, and you don't." And then you're going to come back. And I think there are so many places in Scripture that are just filled with the travail of the tormented soul. The life of David is such a good example. It's full of this. That I think, to get to your question, how can an artist be encouraged to negotiate that and navigate that as an artist in the church? Is one of the ways you can do that, where you'll never have to make an apology for yourself, is tell the story of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
Tell these stories. Tell the stories that you find in Scripture that you relate with, of broken people who are stuck and who are tormented and who are struggling. Tell those stories as they're told in Scripture, because you don't have to apologize for that. There's this great, oh, I love it. There's this story where David is king, and he is going from, his son Absalom has kind of inserted himself into the a position of authority, and David is now in danger, and there's a possible coup, and he and his men are fleeing Jerusalem. And this is after, obviously it's after David and Bathsheba and all the other stories. And it's also after David is just, he's this poet, he's this man after God's own heart, he's this mighty warrior, he's also this man who has treated people badly in places where he's accumulated wives, and he's neglected at times upholding the righteousness of the Lord for fear of losing the good graces of people. And now he's suffering for that, and he's paying the price for that. And so he's with his men, and he's going to Jericho to get away from Jerusalem, laying low. And there's this guy named Shimei, who's of the house of Saul, who shows up while they're walking through this valley. And Shimei's up on the rim, and he's shouting down at David, and he's saying, "You're a bloodthirsty man, and you deserve everything that you're getting right now. And it's, you need to get out of here. Get out of Jerusalem." And he's jeering at him, and he's taunting him, and he's mocking him, and he's angry at him. And David's men say, "Do you want us to go up and take care of this guy? We can silence that voice right now if you'd like for us to. Let us go do that." And David's response, this is a tormented, broken man, says, "Leave him alone, because how do we know that the Lord hasn't sent him to tell me these things?"
Yeah.
Let him say it, and let the Lord sort it out.
Wow.
And there's this beautiful little line at the end of that little passage that says they arrived at their destination by the river, and they were exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that, because I think that's the story. You get to a place where you meet some kind of a refreshment, and you're just tired.
Mm-hmm.
You're tired from all of the voices, and you're tired from the journey, and you're tired from the broken relationships and the dysfunction and the things that you know you're guilty of, and the things that you're like, even if he's not accusing me of things that I am guilty of, I'm guilty of other things.
Right.
And they arrive, and Scripture is full of this kind of stuff. It's full. It does not flinch, and it does not look away from the difficulty of the mental health journey for all of us.
So beautifully said. So beautifully said. There's such liberation for the artist in that, and there's such liberation for the artist in the books that you've written. Rembrandt is in the Wind, and Van Gogh has a Broken Heart. I'm looking forward to getting these in the hands of our listeners. And Russ, I just want to say before we go that I'm really thankful for you as a pastoral figure who has given such a place for the artist in the work that you're doing in the spiritual community. And I just want to thank you for being a voice and for joining me today on the Makers and Mystics podcast.
Thank you so much. This has been a really great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you for listening to the Makers and Mystics podcast. This episode was produced by me, Stephen Roach, with music provided by Somewhere at Sea. If you'd like to go deeper into these conversations on art, faith, and culture, please consider becoming a monthly patron and joining our community of artists and creatives from around the world. Visit patreon.com/makersandmystics and join in the conversation today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again next week. And until then, keep creating. The world needs your art.